Good afternoon. So today we're going to talk about synchronization. Last time we introduced how you use threads with the POSIX API, the pthreads API, and we talked about the idea of atomic operations, that if I want to do things with multiple threads at the same time, I need some way of coordinating between threads. And to do this, we need to know, well, what happens when I access something that's shared between two threads at the same time? And we have this concept of an atomic operation where there's some change to this shared thing that happens all at once. So I can't see a partial result. So for example, if I write 2 to a value, I don't want to see like some of the bits changed and not all of them. I want to see 2 or the previous value, nothing in between. And something which provides that is known as an atomic operation. And we learned that on multi-core systems, that atomic operations weren't the same thing as instructions. That you might think, if we think about how running multiple programs on one core worked, that well, we get interrupted at some instruction, we stop at that instruction and start the other program at a different instruction. Therefore, I can rely on some number of instructions being done whenever you switch between programs, but that's not what happens on multi-core as far as when things change. We saw that we had this single add instruction that got split up into pieces, so it wasn't atomic, that we could see parts of the add happening at different parts, namely that the add needed to load the old value and store a new value, and apparently that did not all happen in one operation, so sometimes we loaded a value and stored a value, while some other adds must have happened in between. That resulted in these confusing results. And we said, well, let's say we have atomic loads and stores. Can we build this notion of a lock? So our locks were going to provide us with mutual exclusion, that there's some task, like filling the fridge with milk, if we don't have any, that we want to do, but only have one person do them, namely one thread do them at a time. We also saw this example with the scheduler. We only want one thread at a time to manipulate the list of runnable processes so you don't get confused about which processes are runnable while that's changing. So we have this lock abstraction. We saw that there was a way to build it from load and store, but that's really inconvenient. Then we talked about, well, starting to implement it, let's think about only the single core case. And there, the only thing we need to worry about is what if another program runs while we have the lock interrupting us, and we could stop that by disabling the interruptions, by saying, yeah, you'd have that key press you're responding to, let's stop that while we have the lock. And this is in fact what XP6 does for its locks, because it's in the operating system, and it can trust that it's not gonna cause any bad effects like hanging the system with the code that needs locks, and this is maybe the simplest way of saying, don't interrupt this task. So the single core part of XP6's locks is it just disables interrupts so it knows that we won't switch to another program while we're handling this shared thing. And one example is the scheduler, so when we're trying to schedule a new program, we won't have an interrupt that tries to schedule a new program while we're still scheduling a new program. That's not going to work out very well if we tried to do that. So we just disable it to stop that. Okay, so any questions about what we covered last time? Okay, so we talked about this notion that, well, some of our instructions are split into multiple pieces, but at least we have atomic loads and stores. And that's like something that real processors do. And unfortunately, the real story is a little more complicated than that. We do have atomic loads and stores, but they don't work the way we think. So here's an example program. I have two functions written in assembly, thread A and thread B. The thread A function sets x, which is a global variable, to 1, then reads y into EAX, its return value, and returns that. And we have thread B, which loads a global variable y with 1, then reads x into its return value and returns that. And we run these both in separate threads and report their results. That's what this C code does after setting x, y to 0 before we start any of the threads. And what we'd expect is that, well, one possibility is we run the first move in A and the first move in B in some order. We could run the A1 first or the B1 first, doesn't matter, but we run them both, and then we run the second line of A and B. In that case, we'd expect them both to return 1. Another possibility is that we run thread A's move into X before thread B runs. In that case, we'd expect thread B to return 1, and thread A will get the initial value of Y, which is 0. Or we could have the opposite and have thread B runs first, so we write into X after thread B has already read it, then read 1, which thread B wrote, in thread A, and return that, and we get 1, 0. So those are what we expect based on the idea that each of these moves happens in order. They happen all at once or not at all. These are all our possibilities with all the orderings. So questions on what the possibilities look like. Okay, so I ran this on my desktop 100 million times, and here are the results I got. And you may notice there's a fourth result I got. And you might say, gosh, the CPU must be buggy, and it's not. That is behavior that is documented by Intel. You might say, what are they doing? I thought you said we have atomic loads in stores. And in fact, we do. There's this little corner case, which is not technically making loads and stores not atomic. They're just running them in a different order. You might say, that seems really useless. And also, it seems like a really good way to cause like really subtle bugs. Look at, that's literally less than 1 in 1,000,000. Imagine if this caused a bug in some real software, like how hard it would be to figure out. Yeah, so what's happening, what causes this like strange case here, is that they're atomic, but they're run out of order. And if you might vaguely remember from some architecture course that modern processors, to be faster, they are out of order processors. So they don't run instructions in the order they appear in the program. They try to run them in another order. And there's good reasons for this. One reason is that if we have slow caches, we can run things that don't depend on the cache while we're waiting for the cache. That makes things a lot faster. We might have some instructions that are faster than others. We can run them all at the same time and hide the slower instructions in general. And processors, though, do this usually invisibly. If you've heard of out-of-order processors, you've heard of it as something the processor does under the hood that you, as an assembly programmer, don't worry about. And that's because the processor is supposed to track the side effects and make things work as if in order. Like if you're reading a value into a register, it's going to prevent you from looking at that register until that read actually finishes, even if it runs at the wrong time. But they only do this, typically, within a thread. Between cores, they often don't do this as much. They do some of it, but not as much. Yes?
How is that the last option is possible, that we go back to 0, if we go back to the previous slide?
Yeah. So how is this possible? It's only possible because some reordering happened. So basically what the processor decided to do is it said, load X before I store Y. Execute the load of X before the store of Y. So what the processor said is that I'm going to do this load of X here. I'm going to do it early. Because, hey, we have this store of Y. Why should I wait for that store of Y to complete when I could already get X right now? So the decision they've made is, why delay that load when I have that value in my cache? Let's just use it and move on. And the alternative decision, the reason they didn't decide to do this, is that they have to say, doesn't matter that you have that value, you can't use it, sorry. And you need to try again after we finish that store. So the processor has decided that they don't want to do that because that's too slow. And their intuition is that, well, X and Y probably aren't related. Why would they be related? Just coincidence. It turns out in this case, that's wrong. But in many real cases, it might be right, and that's what the performance intuition behind doing this is. And you could reasonably say processors shouldn't do this. That's a reasonable opinion, and you might even find some processor designers who agree with you. But the reality is that most modern processors do things like this. Now, they don't just do this willy-nilly. They don't just say, we'll just move loads all over the place. They have restrictions. It's not the Wild West of decide how to execute your program. And for example, here are x86's restrictions. I'm putting them on the slide so you can know what they are, not because I'm going to test you on them. So the restrictions are that each core sees its own loads and stores in the order that they're written in the program. So you won't notice that there's reordering within your own thread on one core. But stores from other cores appear in a consistent order, meaning that if one core sees x changes to 1, then 2, every core is going to see that if the x is set on different cores. But a core is allowed to observe its own store too early. So if you set x to 3, you might think that x goes from 3 to 1 to 2, and other cores might think it goes from like 1 to 3 to 2. And there's also this restriction called causality, that if one core reads A from X and then writes B into Y, that we guarantee that if another core reads that new value of Y, they won't read an older value of X than what was used to produce it. So these are the restrictions they put in place. And it turns out that these restrictions still let you do a whole lot without actually worrying about them. But not everything. It also turns out that these restrictions are extremely difficult to reason about. Like if I show you a program and these rules, it's actually really, really, really hard to figure out what can actually happen here. And by really hard, I mean we won't be doing that. Like grad courses often avoid doing that. It's nasty. But people do it sometimes. So we're not going to depend on those rules. Instead, we're going to use some other tools to make the hardware do what we want. I'm telling you about this reordering because I want to point out that these tools are very much not optional because of this reordering thing that you can't take shortcuts around this unless you actually go through the details of figuring out what does this mean for my program, which you can do, but it's most people don't bother, and it's probably usually not worth it if your program is kind of complicated. So instead, we're going to rely on some special instructions. So Intel, when they decided that they're going to do all this crazy ordering, they provided us some instructions. Particularly instructions for making locks and things like that, which are going to have stronger and simpler ordering rules, where it's just going to be like, no, there's no reordering around this instruction. Like, everything that happens before it actually will happen before it, as far as everyone sees. And there are also some special instructions called fences that restrict the ordering of instructions. So the idea is that you have a load, it's really eager, it wants to go early, but it can't cross the fence. The fence is going to stop it from happening early, even though it's rushing to be executed. And these are just to restrict ordering, so you can say, take all the things before this fence instruction, do them before you do all the things after. Don't do reordering there. Okay, so questions about these two ideas? And we'll go through examples of what these two types of special instructions are in a bit. Okay, so I talked about processors doing reordering, and processors aren't the only problem here. And I avoided anything else being the problem because I wrote assembly. But sometimes you're going to write C or C++. And compilers do this sort of trick too. So here, I have some code where I set note from Alice to 1, and then I have a loop waiting for note from Bob to be true, which, if you remember, was our solution with atomic loads and stores to the synchronization problem. If I compile this with my compiler says, oh, what I should do, well, you're accessing note from Bob over and over again, so I'm going to put that in a register for you and just check the register. So we're loading note from Bob once, then just checking if our register, which will never change again after we load note from Bob, becomes magically not zero. Or magically becomes, you know, something else. Becomes zero, which is never going to happen. And this is because our compiler is making a similar assumption to the processor. It's assuming I don't need to worry about what's going on in all those other threads. I only need to look at your code running in your thread, and I can pretend it's the only thing running. If you want the compiler to assume otherwise, you better have something in there to tell it. And this code does not. And this happens in other ways. So here, for example, I have two values for note from Alice. I have a waiting note with value 1, and I'm a done waiting note with value 2. And the compiler helpfully says, oh, you're writing 2 after writing 1. Well, this 1 value is never going to be the value of note from Alice. Why would I even bother storing it? That's a wasted instruction. So it helpfully removed that instruction for me and decided the only thing it's going to do is store 2 at the end, because why would we need to store 1? It's just going to get replaced by 2. So this is completely valid if we don't worry about the other thread, and that's what the compilers assume, unless you tell them otherwise. So how do you tell them otherwise? Well, pthreads has a solution for you. Many of the pthreads functions, usually matching your intuition, prevent reordering. So they both tell the processor and the compiler, hey, don't do these tricks on me. I want things to happen. So they prevent reordering across them. So the intuition you should have is if you do a lock, when you acquire the lock, pthreads is going to make sure that anything you load in the lock with the lock held actually happens after you get the lock and not before. And anything you store with the lock held actually is stored before you release the lock and not after. It's going to stop that reordering from happening to make the lock work correctly. And the same is also true of other things, like pthread create. It's going to make sure that anything you write for the new thread to read is going to be written before that thread starts. Pthreads joins is going to make sure anything that thread has written somewhere is going to finish before the join returns. So they handle all of this. So they handle implementing special instructions to tell the compiler, to tell the processor, hey, don't do reordering, I have a lock here. And they also tell the compiler, hey, there's another thread going on, please don't do these optimizations that assume there's no other thread going on. So use the pthread functions, don't come up with your own synchronization unless you deal with these really subtle issues about fixing the reordering. Questions about this idea? Okay, so as for like what do these special instructions look like, I'm going to give an example in C++ and the generated assembly. So C++ in the 2011 standard has an atomic header with utilities for doing atomic operations. And unlike the like naive atomic load stores we talked before, these also deal with atomic operations that don't do reordering that would confuse you. So you can say, don't reorder with these. Like, they're the atomic load you were hoping for when you looked at that example and say, how can we get 2 zeros? You could also handwrite assembly code. But we'll look at, you know, given our code, what has happened. So here, I'm using that library. And in my loop, I'm putting a fence. And there's this argument here, which we won't talk about what it means, but that's the usual value you want. And what this is saying is, hey, I would like you to make sure that anything, any loads and stores that happened before this fence function call finish before the fence happens. Any loads and stores afterwards don't start until after the fence happens. So basically, I'm partitioning my loads and stores. I'm doing this in a loop. So what that does is it means that loading to test for one iteration of the loop has to read the value again each time. Because I'm saying you can't keep it around the processor. I don't want you loading early, nor do I want the compiler loading, note from Bob, early. I'm saying wait until when I want you to do it a new time each time this loop happens. That idea makes sense? That's what it says. And when we implement this, two things happen. First, the compiler says, OK, I guess I won't put it in a register for you. I'll actually do a compare with the memory location. And the other thing is it adds this instruction to tell the processor, hey, I don't want reordering here. And that's this special instruction called mFence on x86-64. And that ensures that both that we get a fresh value of note from Bob every time, and more importantly, that note from Alice is written before we check note from Bob. That we don't do the store, the compiler, the processor is not allowed to write note from Alice after we do the compare because of that mFence instruction. Okay, questions? So the C++ Atomics library also has another way of writing this where you can have an atomically wrapped integer for our notes, and we can use store and load operations, and the compiler figures out when we need to add fences and so on. And note that it does things a little differently here. It loads note from Bob with a move because it actually knows knows that the default ordering is enough that we don't actually need an mFence instruction, because if you pay really careful attention to those rules I showed you earlier, it was good enough without one. Okay. So this is the API the C library, C++ library has. We will mostly not be using this, or almost entirely not be using this. We'll talk about some of the types of operations that you have access to and what we can do to implement higher level things, and the higher level things are what we use. Okay, so you saw this mFence instruction. You might say, well, why don't we just do that all the time? And it turns out that the mFence instruction is pretty expensive. There's two costs. So one cost is we have to actually finish all the loads and stores, which might take a bunch of time. And even without that, like it's like 33 cycles on a relatively recent Intel processor. It's not cheap. But like it's better than getting the wrong answer, so you're going to do it. Okay. And I'm also going to mention that I showed you the C++ standard library way of doing it because it's the standard. Their GCC has some built-in functions which compete with that and do the same thing. And I mentioned them because XV6 uses those. So when you look at the XV6 source code, you'll see these __ sync things. That's what it is. It's accessing these instructions that guarantee that reordering and so on won't happen. Okay, so questions on reordering in general. Okay, so we talked about the processor interfaces, and I'd like to talk about, well, why are we tempted to do reordering? And so with caches, well, we know about caches. How do caches actually work with a multi-core system? And this is something we don't really talk about in like computer architecture here, so we're gonna think about, well, we have multiple caches, how do we actually make them work? Or even if we have multiple CPUs, how do we make them work? And we're gonna have a simplified model for what does multiple cores look like. And my model is I have a bunch of cores marked CPU 1 through 4 and some memory. And these are going to be connected on this shared communication line. And the idea is that one person communicates at a time, we have some hardware mechanism to detect if someone else is communicating and take turns. And there are tagged messages on here. So the tag might say, be like an address, and the memory knows I'm responsible for this range of addresses. So if I get a message with that tag, I'm going to do a load or store based on that. Okay. And this is a real way that you might connect CPUs and memory, and historically a relatively common way. It's not ubiquitous because it has some problems. In particular, 4 cores seems kind of okay. 16 cores, we might be running into some problems because there's only one wire, set of wires. So, whoops. We'll gloss over this issue, but there are other designs. We're just using this way of connecting processors because it's going to be the easiest to explain what goes on. Now, let's talk. We have our CPUs connected to each other. Now we need caches. And I implied that when we have a slow store from a cache, you know, we want to get it quickly. And our caches would be even slower if we had to like go to another CPU to get them through this shared bus. So that's not what we're going to do. Each CPU, each core, is going to keep its own cache. But there's a problem here, which is, well, that means that two CPUs can have copies of the same value. So let's say CPU 1 has address A300 cached and increments it. Now CPU 2 also has it cached, and that value needs to change at some point, and so does the value in memory for that address. So the question is, how do we make that happen, and when do those values change? And this problem is known as cache coherency. We need to decide how to keep the caches in sync, you know, how to actually do that. And I'm going to talk about probably the most common way of doing this, which is based on what we'll call snooping the bus. We're going to take advantage of the fact we have this shared communication line, and every processor actually gets to see every single read and write to memory. Because there's one connection here, if CPU 2 talks to memory, CPU 1's getting the message anyways. And we're going to take advantage of that and just say, that's not a bug, that's a feature. It's good that everyone knows what everyone else is doing. That way they can keep track of things that are relevant to them. So we're going to take advantage of knowing when someone else is reading a value from memory in order to make sure our caches stay in sync with them. So that's the preview. Now, to do this, we're going to keep some information for each cache block. So we're going to keep things in sync on a cache block by cache block level, because that's the only thing we can update in our cache. We can't like easily update parts of a cache block. And we're going to track for each cache block whether it's up to date or not, essentially. So if you remember valid and dirty bits, we're going to keep the same kind of information, but we want to know a little bit more than whether it's just valid or dirty, and we're going to see what that extra information is. So we're going to have a state, and I'll show you what the states I'm choosing are later, for each cache block, and each cache is going to track a state for each block it's storing. Two caches storing the same address might have different states for the same data, and that's okay. And we're going to update that based on when we do reads or writes, or when we observe someone else doing a read or a write. And we're going to do that in a way that keeps our values consistent, and I'm going to show you what that is precisely in a set. And the states I'm going to use are these three. So the first state is modified. The modified state means that this cache has this value, and it's a value which is more up to date than memory. So it's an updated value, it's been written to, and it's more up to date than memory. We also have a shared state, that this cache has this value, but it's the same as memory and or the same as other caches. And we also have an invalid state, which is that we don't have a copy of this value. Which probably just means we don't have that stored in our cache at all. So these are the states we're going to start with. And to make sure that we don't disagree on what a value is, we're going to have a rule. And our rule is going to be about this modified state, that we're only going to allow one cache to have a particular piece of data in the modified state at a time. And this way, if there's an updated value, only one cache can have it. And we're going to be even stricter than that, that if a cache has the value in the modified state, every other cache, in fact, has to have that same address as invalid. And this means that when we update a value, no one else is going to be allowed to get that value until we write it back to memory. And that's how we're going to keep everyone in sync. So questions on this idea here?
Yeah.
So when we have an updated value, we are going to be the only ones who have it in our cache at all. Everyone else is going to have that value as invalid, and they're going to have to try to go to memory to get a copy of it. Yeah?
If when the CPU that modifies it is writing it to memory and everything's on the bus, why does it have to fetch it again from memory instead of getting it directly off the bus?
If the CPU that modifies it writes it...
The CPU that has the value in the cache in the shared state, when it gets modified and written to memory, why doesn't it pull it off the bus instead of having to go to memory again?
So the question is, if we observe it being written to memory, couldn't we get the value we observe instead of going to the memory? Yes. But we have to go to the bus, I should say, to get that value, to be more precise. Yeah.
And does this also mean that caches have to be right through so that all of the values are written immediately?
The question is, does this mean that caches have to be right through? No. Because what we can do here, we're going to support write back because we can have it in the modified state as long as we can prove no one else has a valid copy. So we're still going to allow write back caches where we can have a value in our cache that we're modifying, but we're going to be careful and make sure that while we're doing that, no one else has a copy of the value. And no one else tries to get a copy of the value. So this is what our scheme looks like with states. So initially, we don't have something in our cache, so it's invalid. And if we want to read it, we're going to go to the shared state, and we're going to read it by asking on the bus for a copy of the value. If we want to write it, we're going to go to the modified state by writing a copy of the value we want on the bus. So that's just as before, basically, except we go to shared for reading and modified for write. If we're in the shared state, meaning we've read the value previously, for example, then if we want to write it, we're going to send the value on the bus or send something on the bus, and we're going to actually go to the modified state. If we hear that someone else is writing the value, note that we don't care what the value is. If we just hear that they're writing it, we're going to go to invalid. So when we want to write the value, we need to tell everyone we're writing the value, but we don't actually need to tell them what value we're writing. We just need to tell them, this address, I'm changing it, you stop caching it. And that's typically all we'll say. We'll just say, I'm writing the value. I'm going to keep it in my cache as modified. I'm just going to tell you I'm writing the value, and I'm set. And if we're in the shared state and we want to read, we don't need to do anything. We just read the value out of our cache. It's fine. So in the modified state, if we hear that someone else is reading it, then we need to act. So we need to let them read it, and to do that, we need to send the value back on the bus and back into memory. And when we do that, we know that we no longer have a more up-to-date version, so we go to share. If we hear someone else is writing it, we need to write back our changes before that person goes, and then go to invalid just as if we were in share. Because we know that they're the exclusive writer of the value, not us. If we have it in the modified state and we want to read it, we just read it from our cache. We have a cache copy of the up-to-date version of the value. It's fine. If we want to write it, well, we already told everyone else we were writing it, so we don't need to do anything. We can update our cache copy, and that's fine. And we know it's fine because we know that someone else who wants a copy of that value is going to tell us they're trying to read or write it, and we can tell them when they do that, hey, here's the real version you want. Okay, so questions, yes?
So when you mean transition requires sending message on the bus, does that require like extra cycles and like for?
So the question is, when it requires a message on the sending a message on the bus, does that require extra time? And the answer is yes. There's actually a cost here. And probably a more important part of the cost is that if someone else is using the bus, we have to wait. We might have to wait. And also, there's some subtlety here that, like, for this modified thing, the bus needs to have some way of ensuring that we, like, tell the person trying to read the value in time, here's the real version of it. Which I'm not going to talk about how you would do that, but that there needs to be a mechanism to let us do that. Let us make sure we go early enough that they don't go to memory instead. Okay, other questions? Okay, so let's go through an example here. So I have two caches. We've read a bunch of values, and we have them all in this shared state. And let's say CPU1 wants to increment our A300. So we're going to tell on the bus, we're going to say, hey, I'm writing this value. And we could update memory, but we don't have to. But we do need to tell the other processor, hey, I'm updating this value. And the other processor says, OK, I'm going to get rid of my copy. If we want to update the value later, we can just increment it in our cache because we know no one else is going to get confused by that because they'll have to ask on the bus for a copy of the value first. So now we have 102, we incremented it twice, and note the second time it was entirely local. So it's not the case that we're going to the bus for every operation, we're just going to start things, and then we're done. Then later on, let's say CPU2 wants to figure out what the value is, it's going to ask on the bus, hey, what's the add value at that address? I need to read it. And at this point in time, we're going to say, oops, we better like quickly update memory. There we go, okay? Now we're set. Now you got it. And now CPU2 gets to read that value. It could either have read it from memory or it could have listened in when we were updating memory. Either way works. Okay. Yeah.
When you make something invalid, you still keep in the cache, you just have a state.
So when you're making something invalid, well, so here I've just I've kept it in the cache. Like in practice, like we would might replace this with something else to cache.
Okay, so you can actually yeah. evict it.
Yeah, we can evict it. It's like it's not useful to keep in our cache. But like the simplest thing to do for implementing a cache is set a bit for invalid. If you remember when we learned about caches in whatever the prereq you took for this class was, you probably learned about a valid bit.
Sure.
Maybe. I only know the CS prereq, so I could be wrong, but there's a valid bit in caches typically, so the simplest thing is you flip that bit, and that just says to ignore everything else in that part of the cache. But you would typically say, if I have something else to store in the cache, well, there's a lot place I can store it, because I'm sure not using that for anything useful right now. Yeah?
What keeps CPU2 from reading before CPU1 writes?
So the question is, what keeps CPU2 from reading before CPU1 writes? Nothing. But when CPU2 does the read, whenever it does it, it's going to ask on the bus. So CPU1 will get a chance to reply and say, no, 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 here's the value you want.
So can memory beat CPU1?
So something that we have to guarantee is that CPU1 will always beat memory. And that's going to be part of our bus design is going to ensure that somehow.
If CPU2 wanted to update it instead? would it also have to say what's the value?
So if CPU 2 wanted to update it instead, so CPU 2 would not have to say what the new value is. Or CPU, would CPU 1 or CPU 2?
CPU 2 updates.
If CPU 2 is updating, it's going to say, I'm updating the value. And CPU 1 is going to write back its new value first. But CPU 2 doesn't actually need to say what it's updating it to. It just needs to say, I'm updating, get rid of your other copies. So our basic procedure with this scheme is that when we want to write a value, we invalidate everyone else's copy. We could send the new value we want, or we can just send, hey, I'm updating this. And in many real implementations, we actually just send, hey, I'm updating this, because a cache block might be pretty big, like 16, 32 bytes. That saves a bunch of time only sending the address. Note that I haven't talked about like cache replacement, but that still happens. We still like run out of space in our cache, and that's fine. We just write it back if it's modified. And we just get rid of it if it's shared. So these are our states. So modified, the value may be different than what's in memory, and I am the only one who has it. And we guarantee that property by invalidating other people's copies. We have the shared, where the value is the same as memory, and we guarantee that property by when someone tries to read, anyone who has a modified version writes it to memory before they finish their read. And invalid is I don't have the value, which means I'm going to ask for it no matter what was previously in my cache. I don't care if I had any leftover bits, I'm going to ignore them. Okay. So this is a simple way of keeping caches in sync, and this is enough if we don't do silly things like reordering loads and stores to give us in-order atomic loads and stores. And this sort of thing is what processors do, but they often implement a few little extensions. So examples of extensions might be, maybe we want to be able to read a value that we intend to write later, but not actually tell everyone else to invalidate their copies yet. Another example is that sending values between caches directly without actually writing it back to memory. Another example is that if we have like 16, 32 cores, we might want some way of not telling everyone about every read and write. So there are extensions to this. If you want to learn about them, take graduate computer architecture. But I just gave you the simplified view so you have an idea, how is this even possible that we keep the caches in sync? So we went through the simple version. Okay. So questions about cache coherency? Okay, so now that we know how we keep these caches in sync, we're going to go back to building blocks. And the useful thing is that now that we know how caches are kept in sync, we can understand how the processor can easily provide special instructions that are going to help us build locks. And these instructions are going to be what are called read, modify, write instructions. Atomic read, modify, write. So this is an instruction that atomically reads a value, modifies it, and then writes it back. And it seems like, if we thought about memories working, you can load and store values over the bus. It doesn't seem like you can do that, but cache coherency actually gives us the tool to do that. And our tool is that first we get our cache block containing the value in the modified state, then we modify and write it. And while we're doing that, we know no one else has a copy of the value, so no one else is going to see the value in the middle of that change. And that's why it's going to be atomic. So cache coherency actually makes it really easy to implement these instructions that do more than just an atomic load or store, even though that's not something the memory itself supports. And let's give an example of an atomic instruction on x86. So lock exchange is an atomic exchange instruction. So this instruction reads from ECX into a temporary, copies EAX into memory at the location ECX, and then copies that temporary into EAX. Or another way of thinking about it is it reads from memory at address ECX and swaps it with EAX. It's an atomic swap between a register and a location in memory. And the way this works is to execute this instruction, the processor gets that cache block in the modified state, then reads its value and with it still in the modified state and writes EAX into it. And because it's in the modified state, we know no one else is reading in the middle of that or writing in the middle of that. So it's actually atomic. We don't have to worry about this. And this seems only modestly more useful than a loader or a store, but it turns out that this is going to actually make it pretty easy to implement a lock that works on multi-core. So what we're going to do is we're going to write a new value and read an old value. And our new value is going to be to mark a lock as taken. So we're going to implement a lock. The way we're going to implement it is that it's going to be one memory location, and we're going to mark it as taken when it's acquired. And this instruction is going to serve to write that it's taken. So we're going to swap a value indicating it's taken. And it's also going to let us read the previous value, so the value before we changed it. And what we want to see is, was it already taken? If the previous value says it wasn't taken, then we got the lock. We are the only run running with the lock. Otherwise, we didn't, and we'll try again. So here is a spin lock on 64-bit x86 with exchange. And what I'm doing here is I have a global variable that represents my lock. I'm going to say that to 1 if someone has the lock, 0 otherwise. So it's initially 0. And what I do is I put 1 into EAX, and I swap that 1 with the value of the lock. Okay. So now, after this swap instruction, EAX is going to contain 0 if no one else had the lock before me, and 1 otherwise. If it contains 1, I'm going to try again. And keep doing that over and over again, and eventually that person will give up the lock and I'll succeed. If it contains 0, I'm done, I acquired the lock. For releasing, I'm going to have a memory fence, so I'm going to make sure everything I did with the lock actually happens before I tell anyone about the lock being done. And then I'm going to store 0 in the lock to indicate that now it's free. After I do that, someone who runs this exchange instruction is going to see, oh, I swapped 1 with 0, I got the lock now. And it's because that we're doing this set to 1 and read the old value in a way where no other processor can get in the middle of it that we guarantee that we can be sure that we're the only one who did this 1 to 0 0 to 1 transition. Okay, so questions about how this works? And you can see from the slide title, this is known as a spin lock. And it's called a spin lock because we do what is known as spinning in a loop a lot while we're trying to get it, if we can't just get it right away. Okay, and it turns out that we have memory order guaranteed. It was obvious here that this mFence is for memory order. Intel helpfully says that all the lock instructions do the right thing with respect to memory order, that if you have a store before them, it will actually finish before the lock happens, which is really nice, because otherwise confusing things could happen. So we saw this atomic exchange operation, and there are a variety of instructions that processors provide to help implement things like locks. So atomic exchange is one of them. And this is like pseudo C code for what that instruction does. Another common one is test and set. where you just supply an address, and it sets the address to 1 and tells you if it was previously 0, 1 or not. So that's another common instruction. We just simulated that with exchange, right? We did the same thing with exchange, except we aren't checking if old, we get the actual old value and check if it was 0 ourselves. But the key thing is that both of these are ways of providing an operation where we read a value, modify it, and write it all at once. And sometimes there are more complicated things that might be more useful. So one example is this compare and swap operation. So here, I supply an address, and we read the value at the address, and if it's equal to a particular value, I write a particular new value. Otherwise, I don't, and I return whether or not I updated it. So this is like actually way more powerful than that atomic exchange. We can do lots of useful things with it. And another example is that you might have fetch and add. So we can add to a value and get what was before we did the add. And this, in fact, exists on x86, along with this compare and swap also exists on x86. And some of these more powerful atomic operations, we can do interesting things with directly without actual locks. So for example, let's say I want to append to a linked list. I can find the end of the list, and I can swap null, compare and swap, to say, if the end of the list is null, change it to the new node. And because that's an atomic operation, I don't need to worry that two people are going to try to change the end of the list at the same time. Because if that happens, if we look at our pseudocode, the instruction is going to say, okay, oh, you didn't actually change the value, try again. And that's what this loop does here. So we have a loop here. We find the end of the list, change the value at the end of the list, try again if we didn't actually change it. And this try to change it is just saying, here's the current value. It should have been null. And if you changed it from null to new last node, you're done. Otherwise, try again. So questions? On our extra atomic operations. And you can see in that like this common pattern we have for atomic operations, which is that we try to do something, see if it failed, if not, try again. And that's the pattern you'll see all over with these atomic operations. That we just try to do it, see if we succeeded, if not, we try again and again and again. And that's how we can manage to get useful coordination done between different threads. Okay, so any about this? So I showed you the example of that sort of assembly written spin lock. It turns out that in XV6, the actual spin lock is very similar to that. But it combines the two things we talked about for implementing locks. So first, it disables interrupts. And you might say, why, if we're doing the spin lock thing, do we need to disable interrupts? Well, the problem is the thing that interrupts us might want to do something with the lock. For example, maybe it wants to read the list of processes. But if we have the lock, it can't do that until the interruption finishes, which will never happen because it's going to wait until it can get the lock. So to avoid this problem, XV6 just says, while someone has a spin lock, we don't allow interrupts to happen. So the spin lock part is just for coordinating between cores. And then we have the exact exchange I showed you in that assembly example, where we try to set the lock to 1 with the single instruction and see if it was previously 0. And while it wasn't 0, we keep trying again and again and again. And then we have an indication to the compiler that, hey, don't reorder my loads and stores. Really, don't do it. Please stop. So that's our acquire. And our release is we say, hey, don't reorder my loads and stores, and set the lock to 0. And also undisable interrupts. which is this pop CLI. Questions about this? Okay. So this is a spin lock, and this is typically how the internals of operating systems do coordination. But spin locks have a few problems, some of which we can solve, and some of which we're going to want a different mechanism for. So one problem is that spin locks are actually pretty bad for that shared bus. So what's going to happen with a spin lock? Here I have a lock variable, and CPU1 has it in its cache as locked. So it just acquired the lock, it set it to locked, it's set. And let's say CPU2 comes along, and it says, okay, I want to try to lock the lock myself. So it's going to tell everyone, hey, I want to modify the lock. Okay, and CPU1's going to write out its value, and CPU2's going to see, oh, it's locked. Okay, it's still locked. It was previously locked. I didn't get the lock. And maybe CPU3 comes along and does the same thing. Now, but both CPU2 and CPU3, if we remember our code for the lock, what they're going to do next is execute another loop trying to acquire the lock. So they're going to say, again, hey, other processor, I want to modify the lock. And they're going to keep doing this over and over again, sending messages on this bus, back and forth, until eventually CPU1 sets the lock to unlocked, in which case one of them will get it first and actually figure this out. So this works, it's functional, but we're sending a lot of things on the bus in order to communicate that nothing is changing. And this is because to do the atomic exchange, we say, I want to get this and modified before I do that. And this is a problem because the bus is also going to be used for other things, like, say, whatever CPU1 is trying to do while it has the lock. And this is going to make all of that slower, possibly a lot slower. So there's a fix for this, and that fix is that you don't just use the atomic exchange instruction, that you have a second loop where you just read the lock. And this works better because we can read without telling everyone, I want to modify the value. Instead, we get the value in that shared state, and we just keep it there while no one's modifying it. So this is called test and test and set, and you might get assembly like this. So first, we check if the lock is zero, and keep checking that without doing an actual atomic modify. Then we try to do the atomic modify, and if that doesn't work, well, probably it didn't work because someone else did it right here. And that's okay, we'll just try again later. And this is actually more efficient, even though it seems like it shouldn't be, because like we're checking the lock more often, because I want to read the lock, well, I get a shared copy of it. I want to read the lock, CPU3 gets a shared copy of it. So now everyone gets to read their local cached copy and not use the shared bus. Until CPU1 actually modifies it and tells everyone, hey, invalidate your copy now. So questions on how this worked here? Yeah.
Your previous example of this, why did they go invalid when CPU2 said it wanted to acquire the lock?
Previously, to acquire the lock, it said, I want to modify it. Because it's running the atomic exchange instruction, which writes to the lock. And now, the instruction we're running is this just a compare instruction. So it only wants to read. Now we're still going to end up running the atomic exchange instruction, but first we're going to just try to read normally before we try to do that. So you might say, maybe the processor could do that for us. Maybe the processor could say, you're doing an atomic exchange. First, I'll try to read and see if I actually change the value. They could do that, but they don't. That would be an extra step in the common case. They assume that when you say, I want to do an atomic exchange, I want to write the value, and that's how they implement it. So you've seen that, like, this is like a surprisingly subtle performance issue where we do something not obvious to implement the locks, and it turns out there's a whole wide variety, like a whole class full of ways of implementing locks with atomic operations. And there's all sorts of trade-offs related to things like how much am I using a shared bus, like how efficient it is, and there's even more schemes that like do better. So like in this, even with this test and test and set, we have all these processors trying to modify the lock when they won't succeed. Because the CPU 2 and CPU 3 are both going to try to acquire the lock at the same time. One of them isn't going to get it. We could actually do better than that, and there are schemes which try to do that type of improvement. I just want to mention they exist. They just use atomic operations in a different way to make that happen. So we talked about cache coherency for implementing locks. We'd also like to talk about some performance consequences of cache coherency. So it works on cache blocks. And we've looked at cache blocks as like a single value, but cache blocks are really big. They're like 64 bytes, for example. And if two processors are writing to different parts of the same cache block, as far as the cache coherency is concerned, it's one big value. And if we want to write to any part of that, we need to get the whole thing. So the write instructions are going to happen one at a time, but we have to get the whole cache block to update a little piece of it. And this means that if you try to write to two values that are part of the same cache block, so if we have, you know, 4-byte writes to different parts of the block, these processors are going to compete with each other. They're going to basically have to get the value, the partially updated value for the block from the other, you know, over the bus, rather than keeping a local cache copy. And this can have big performance effects. So here's a program which we get dest as a pointer, and we add into dest, into the, what dest points to, a big array. So I'm adding a lot to this dest value, and I have this function here where I add one thread adds into 0, and one thread adds into something distance elements away. Okay. So when the distance is small, these will be part of the same cache block. And when the distance is large, they won't. And you can actually figure out how big is the cache block. How big do you think it is? Well, probably it's around 64 bytes on the system I have, because suddenly the performance gets better, the time goes down, once I'm writing to things that far apart. Because before that, we're competing. So this is known as full sharing, that we're accidentally synchronizing access to two things which actually aren't independent, because they happen to be shared underneath. And the way they're shared is that there's this one cache block that holds both of them. And if you run into this problem, the solution, separate them. Like, artificially add padding, and it will be faster. Okay, so questions about that? Yeah?
You have a bunch of locks in the program, and you just initiate them as global variables. Would they all be in the same cache block?
If I have a bunch of locks and I initialize them as global variables, will they be in the same cache block?
Yeah.
So often locks are implemented with the padding included in the lock type. So or with some annotation for the compiler to say, maybe spread these out. So hopefully that happened. If not, they might be in the same cache block, and the locks might accidentally cause performance interference with each other. Like, you'll get the correct behavior, but it just might be slower. Other questions? So that's false sharing. So another thing that is a bit problem with spin locks is that they waste CPU time waiting for another thread. And in our operating system, this might not be a big deal, because like in Xv6, we never switch to another thread on that core while we have the lock, so we know that it's not going to be held for very long. We know that if we can't get the spin lock right now, that's because someone else is actively working. But on like my user programs, maybe that program is waiting for a key press. And that's why I can't get the lock. And if that's the case, I don't want to just waste a ton of CPU time waiting for that thread to get a key press. Or maybe that thread isn't running right now because the scheduler hasn't run it. I don't want to just waste a bunch of time waiting for the scheduler to give up on my time slice and start running it. I want to tell the scheduler, hey, you should start running this right now. So we want some better thing to do. And there's going to be another type of lock, which is in fact the type of lock we incidentally introduced, known as mutexes. So mutexes are locks which are not going to do this waiting using all the CPU. Instead, they're going to say, give up the CPU instead of waiting. Now, this is more complicated because now instead of just involving the processor, we need to involve the operating system. We need to tell the operating system, hey, my thread doesn't need the CPU right now, give it to someone else, in a way which still makes the lock work. So conceptually, what's going to happen is when we acquire the lock, we're going to go to sleep and add ourselves to a list of things for the scheduler to run later. When we unlock, we're going to look at that list and tell the scheduler, hey, this thread wants to run. So this is going to be integrated with our scheduler, and the idea is that when we can't get the lock right away, we just put ourselves on a list, and when we release the lock, we don't just set a variable to zero, we check this list and tell the scheduler, hey, here's a thread that should wake up right now. Now, we need this list, and there's a question of, well, how do we make sure that it's safe to change that list? What if two people try to acquire the lock at the same time, and they both want to modify the list at the same time? How do we make sure that's safe? And our answer is, we're going to use a spin lock to do that. So we're going to use a spin lock to implement our better lock. But that's OK, because the spin lock is only protecting this teeny little piece. So we'll get this spin lock for a brief period of time. And then we're just going to use it to change that list, and then we'll get rid of the spin lock. So the lock operation is we're going to get the spin lock, add ourselves to the list, and then wait without the spin lock. And the unlock operation is we're going to get the spin lock, remove something from the list, release the spin lock, wake up that thing we just removed. So the spin lock is only protecting these little short operations for the list. When we're actually waiting, we aren't using the CPU at all. We're just on the list, we can wait. So here's sort of a pseudocode implementation. I have my mutex, which has a spin lock that makes sure I don't have two threads trying to change the wait queue at the same time. And I have a taken variable that's just a normal Boolean. So the taken variable tracks if the mutex is taken or not, and the wait queue is the list of things that are waiting for the lock right now, that tried to acquire the lock, but they found it was being used. And so what we do for locking, we acquire the spin lock, and if the lock's currently taken, we add ourselves to the wait queue, make ourselves not runnable, unlock the spin lock, and run the scheduler. And the scheduler is going to run some other thread, and eventually we'll be marked as runnable again, and the scheduler will switch back to us. And the reason we'll be marked as runnable again is because the unlock operation is going to get the spin lock, check if the wait queue is empty, and if it's not, it's going to mark a thread on the wait queue as runnable. It could also tell the scheduler to run it right away. We don't have to do that. We just need to mark it as runnable so it eventually will start running. Okay. So that's our operation. So instead of unlocking the lock, we just choose a thread to start running next and make them run. So this idea makes sense. So here, rather than marking the lock as not taken, the lock is still taken, but I just hand it off to another thread based on that queue. And I hand it off by just making that thread be able to run again. Okay. So questions about this basic idea? And we have here first. Okay. And something to note is that if only one person tries to get the lock at the same time, this is very similar to the spin lock. We get the spin lock, we see it's not taken, we set it as taken, we release the spin lock. And when we unlock it, if no one else is waiting, we see the queue's empty, we just mark it as not taken and release the spin lock. So it's very similar to the spin lock case when no one wants it. When someone wants it, we do these manipulations of what threads are runnable. Yes?
When you're removed from that list, are you... Give me a second.
Okay, back to you.
Oh, I know what it is.
Okay.
When you're taken off that queue, are you taken off in the order that the locks happened? Or
the question is, when you take off that queue, do you take off in the order the locks happen? That would probably be the highest quality thing to do, but I haven't specified. Okay. Like the most helpful thing to do, but it's not necessarily what you have to do. Okay. So a subtlety to notice here is that there's this is actually really tricky to do right. So one thing that's tricky here is we have to worry about the order of releasing the spin lock and running the scheduler. So something that's subtle is that I need to mark the thread as not runnable before I run the scheduler. Because I want it to be the case that if I'm still runnable, I'll keep running. So I mark the thread as not runnable without releasing the spin lock, because I don't want someone to mark me as runnable, and then I mark myself as not runnable. I can't do that. So that's a subtlety. And in XV6, the equivalent of these locks in XV6, we actually acquire the process table lock here and then run the scheduler. So we acquire the process table lock, set ourselves as not runnable with the process table lock, and switch to the scheduler holding the process table lock. That's their solution to avoid being confused about, do I keep running this thread or not? But there's a subtlety here, which is why we need to do that, is that when I marked as not runnable, if I mark this runnable again, I don't want to start running the scheduler and then have myself be start running on another core before I started running the scheduler. That would be really confusing. Two copies of me running at the same time, which has the right registers. So we need some way of avoiding that. In XV6, the solution is we lock the process table while we're doing this. Linux has a different solution. It has this like, am I on the CPU right now, which is separate from am I runnable, to handle that. Okay. And that's our mutex. But the mutex, the idea is that we have this normal case where we just acquire the spin lock and just check a variable, a boolean. And we have the contended case where we do this, mark myself as not runnable, switch to the scheduler, and when unlocking, check for someone who's waiting and wake them up. And this is how we do not busy waiting anymore. But note that the key idea here is that we're relying on the spin lock to do this. We're building our better locks from these crappy locks that seem really inefficient. Okay, and that's what I have for today.